Hello, I'm Blair Bartram, and this is number 0485, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0485. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Meredith Thomas, who has starred in many holiday films. Her latest is A Christmas in Royal Fashion.
So I play this woman named Melanie, and she's not particularly nice. When I read the script, I actually really wanted to play her because I don't get to play the villain that often. So Melanie is the boss of this PR company. She has the assistant who's the lovely Cindy Busey plays her, and she's the lovely ingenue, and I'm kind of the mean boss. And it really reminded me of the 80s film Working Girl, the Sigourney Weaver character, who is not particularly nice to her assistant, has to go off somewhere, and then her assistant is mistaken for her.
Voice actor Roy Samuelson talks about his gig doing descriptive narration on films for the visually impaired.
It's kind of like listening to a baseball game on the radio. What I do is I do read a script. It's pre-written for me. At the same time, I'm looking at the actual live video and listening to the audio for whatever feature or TV show that I'm narrating. The gist of it is that in between lines of dialogue, there's words that I say to kind of fill in the blanks of what's happening on screen.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter travels to Pittsburgh for Dennis Palumbo's latest crime thriller, Head Wounds. So get your running shoes ready for this race against time. It's coming up very soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0485, was broadcaster and programming guru Blair Bartram, an all-around nice guy who is ingenious when it comes to all things radio. Thank you very much, Blair, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 53-year-old Joseph Bienviage has been charged with smuggling cell phones, drugs, and tobacco into the federal prison in Berlin, New Hampshire. He allegedly admitted that he has been selling such items to inmates for about 7 months, during which time he made $12,000 in cash, not counting the $3,000 to $5,000 that inmates still owe him. Bienviage said that he knew it was a crime to introduce the contraband into FCI Berlin and was aware he could go to prison if he was caught. The cash supplemented the salary from his day job. His day job, you ask? The prison chaplain. I wonder if chaplain contraband could have a Jimmy Swaggart moment where he admits his sins.
I have sinned against you, my Lord. And I would ask that your precious blood would wash and cleanse every stain until it is in the seas of God's forgetfulness.
Get off the stage!
Never to be remembered against me anymore.
Get off the stage!
Wow, I forgot how unforgiving some Christians can be. Well, on the plus side, the chaplain is already well-versed in the prison routine. Yeah. Okay, this next story is one that some of you might find amusing. Personally, I find it disturbing in a way that shows our fall as a civilization. A Bank of America ATM in Houston was the scene of a near riot on November 25th when it began spewing $100 bills instead of tens. Now, after the first lucky driver posted his score on social media, a crowd showed up and stood in line with a few fights and arguments breaking out over about 2 hours until police were summoned and the free money was shut down. Bank of America released a statement the next day that would have galled Ebenezer Scrooge. Customers will be able to keep the money dispensed. Turns out the blame lay with a vendor who incorrectly loaded $100 bills into the $10 slot. There was no report on how much money was withdrawn. Okay, now, since all transactions have a complete documentation trail to them, I'm rather dismayed that the bank isn't going after those who willfully withdrew money knowing they'd get 10 times the value they requested. And I can only hope that the fights that broke out were caused not by greedy people trying to get their share of the money, but rather a few honest people trying to stop those with an apparent lack of morals. Yeah, anyway. Willie Maurice Floyd of Pensacola, Florida, got a 3-year jail sentence for driving when his license had been revoked or suspended more than a dozen times. But he argued on appeal that his driver's license had never been revoked because he never had one. A learner's permit, he argued, is not a driver's license. Unfortunately for him in Florida, it is. It's legally called a learner's driver's license. Therefore, the appeals court ruled he did in fact have a license, it was revoked, and his conviction stands. But by the time the appeals process was over, his sentence was over anyway, and he was probably back out on the road. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, New Zealand high school students who took the National Certificates of Education Achievement Level 3 history exam were instructed to write an essay on a quote from Julius Caesar. That quote was, "In war, events of importance are the result of trivial causes." The problem, many students didn't know the meaning of the word trivial. Students sent a petition to the New Zealand Qualifications Authority with over 2,000 signatures asking them to grade the essays based on each student's understanding of the word, with one of the signers thinking the word meant significant. The NZQA said the word was expected to be in the vocabulary of students at that level, but if they addressed the quote and integrated their ideas, they would be given credit. One student, a fellow named Scott, disagreed. He said it was a common word and the complainers were worried that they would miss out on a high grade. He called their complaint, yep, trivial. Good for you, Scott. And oh, please, give Scott an A. As for the other students, let's hope with the aid of a dictionary they can learn the true meaning of the word trivial, and while they're at it, I hope they're beginning to understand the meaning of the word fail. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? During the holiday season, there are many chances for you to see actress Meredith Thomas. She's starring in the TV film A Christmas in Royal Fashion on ION, but she's starred in previous holiday flicks that have become perennial, such as A Christmas in Vermont with Chevy Chase and the flick The Ugly Christmas Sweater. Meredith joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Meredith.
Hey there.
I think they should say 'tis the season to see Meredith Thomas.
Yeah, I'm trying to get the hashtag trending, a very Meredith Christmas.
Oh, that's good.
I'm up for that.
That's very good. Was it always a desire of yours to be in holiday films, or is this something that just happened organically? You were in one, and then you were in another, and suddenly it's become your thing.
Yeah, I would say it was organic. I auditioned for A Christmas in Vermont, having not worked with this particular production company before, but having worked with some of the people involved in it, and you fought for the role like many other actresses or actors do, and then my role just kept getting better. The writer really had an affinity for this character, Dana. He really loved this strong woman that was kind of mentoring the ingenue in the film. And it just kept getting better and better. Then Chevy came on. And so from there, the next holiday season, I got The Ugly Christmas Sweater, and it's the same production company. And then from there, I got A Christmas in Royal Fashion. So I am really grateful. I say I will be happy to do Christmas movies every year that they will have me. But yeah, I definitely fell into it.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because, of course, a Christmas movie comes out at Christmas, which means it's not shot during the Christmas season. So how do you get into character? How do you get into the Christmas spirit when you're nowhere near the month of December?
It's somewhat easy, and then at times it's not at all easy. So, for example, it's easy when you're inside in a nice on a nice, cool studio, which some of A Christmas in Royal Fashion was shot. So even though it was like 110 in the valley in Los Angeles outside, because I believe we shot late July, early August on this. So it was really hot. So inside, it's all decorated. The caterers even like threw in some Christmas cupcakes at lunchtime to make us feel more festive. And there's, you know, so that's nice. But then the hard part is when you're in your little red wool jacket and you're literally, your sweat is dripping down your microphone on your back because it's the summer in Los Angeles. But I don't know. I think the Christmas spirit is pretty easy to get into, even in the heat. So, I mean, you kind of want to keep that festive, grateful, giving heart all year round. So in some ways, I'm super lucky that I get to celebrate it several times a year.
Well, this current one, A Christmas in Royal Fashion, tell us about what it's about and also the role that you play.
Sure. So I play this woman named Melanie, and she's not particularly nice. When I read the script, I actually really wanted to play her because I don't get to play the villain that often. So Melanie is the boss of this PR company, and she has this assistant who's the lovely Cindy Busey plays her, and she's the lovely ingenue, and I'm kind of the mean boss. And it really reminded me of the 80s film Working Girl, the Sigourney Weaver character who is not particularly nice to her assistant, has to go off somewhere, and then her assistant is mistaken for her. And to bring the royal part into it, it's a prince who mistakes my assistant for me, and then of course, you know, as you can imagine, they fall in love, and I may or may not see the error of my ways and and not be such a Grinch by the end of the film.
You say you've always played nicer parts and that you don't get a chance to play the villain. What was it like having that opportunity this time around?
So it's really fun, and it creates a really nice challenge for an actor, because villains in real life don't walk around, you know, twisting their black mustaches and believing that they're villains. I think that, you know, people that we would say are not particularly nice people, bad people, however you want to put it, they're doing what they know to get by in the world. So for me, it was a fun challenge to make Melanie somewhat comedic, to make her priorities are wrong. So you just approach it in a different way. Like some people's priorities may be love and family. Melanie's are getting ahead. It's the office. She's not particularly into the Christmas spirit. She's all about work. So I would say, it's not approaching them like they're bad people. And then also, I love to just bring a little bit of comedic character to everyone, so it makes them a little easier to tolerate when you can kind of laugh at their ridiculousness.
Of course, you haven't done just Christmas work, and I wanted to touch on something else that you have done. You had a role in FX's feud, Betty and Joan, which is an interesting series that was on FX, and I wanted to bring that one up for a couple of reasons, and that is, here you are playing a role in a show that talks about old Hollywood and the role that women had, even when they were stars, in that situation. The show has since come out around the time of the Me Too movement, and just the idea of roles for women in general, all that swirling around while you were making this, I just wanted to get your thoughts on your situation as an actress in finding the right roles and getting your voice out there as a woman with all that's going on as a backdrop.
Such a good question. It's so interesting that you would ask that, because as I was preparing for this audition, I realized that in some ways Ryan Murphy, who is a big advocate of using more women in directors' roles and kind of shaking things up a little, the irony is that if you went back to 1960, I believe it was 68 or 63. I'm pretty sure it was 63. There actually wouldn't have been a woman on the red carpet interviewing other women, because I did my research. So I was like, okay, well, first of all, just the fact that I'm playing this role, it's not quite true to the year, but I'm really those years. But I'm really happy that I have the opportunity to play this role. And yeah, that was shot prior to. Prior to this past year of everything that's come out in the media. And I think for me, the whole movement there's been some definite downsides, but for the most part, the talk in Hollywood has been positive. It's given people a voice to really come out and talk about what actresses have been going through in Hollywood since Hollywood. And it's not just Hollywood. Women have been going through this since the beginning of time, but because the entertainment industry, there's so much light shined on it, we've actually created a platform where we can talk about it. So for me, I think, like I said, it's been a really good thing. Finally, I feel like actresses can kind of come into their own. And the really great thing is to watch these screen legends. They were kind of, in some ways, they jumped forward in time. These two screen legends are playing screen legends. And then, ironically, ended up being in competition with each other for Emmys, because they were both on the same ballot. So luckily we didn't see any of that fighting like we saw with Betty and Joan over the awards. But there was there's a lot of life imitating art. But for the most part, it's been a tough year in Hollywood, but it's kind of that feeling that, you know, the truth will set you free, but first it's going to make you mad. You know, so there's been a lot of anger. You know, we've had to face some really tough truths. I've been in this business for a long time, so I'm not going to pretend like any of this was a surprise. I think that because of the political climate in the U.S. with the leadership, that this is an absolute direct result of women feeling powerless for so many years and feeling powerless to make change with the political system. So they're making change within Hollywood, within their job, within their families. We're finding where we can have our voices heard, because there's places that we still are not heard.
Well, I know there are other ways that you can make your voice heard. As we mentioned, you're starring in A Christmas in Royal Fashion, which is an ION. But besides that, I understand you're very busy producing web series and short films and doing other work. So you're creating your own work as well.
Yeah, I was kind of, I wouldn't say I was late to the party, but I was kind of late to the party. Like, when I was in my 20s, I realized that smart actresses, as they aged, were buying up scripts and buying up things so that they could produce their own material when the roles dried up for them. Now, luckily, I don't think the roles are drying up as fast as they were 20 years ago, but I definitely learned from what I observed in my 20s of actresses finding their own material and making it. So now I'm just really interested. Every time I read an article on some type of strong woman that made a change in the world, I send myself an email and I'm like, find out about this woman. Has there been a movie made? So for me, there's so many stories to tell, and now we live in this age where there's so many platforms to tell them that I think it would just be silly to not be producing my own stuff. So I'm constantly on the lookout, and I still love it. Producing is hard. It makes you so appreciate the hard work that goes into being on a movie set and what the writers go through and speaking their words. Yeah. So I'll never stop. I always want to be working with other people's material as well, but I'm just starting to figure out where I can get my own voice out there in different ways.
Glad to hear that you're so busy. And again, the TV movie that is on ION is A Christmas in Royal Fashion. Meredith, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Of course. Thank you so much. You have a happy holiday season.
Actress Meredith Thomas, one of the stars of the TV film A Christmas in Royal Fashion on ION. It also airs throughout the holiday season on Super Channel in Canada. You'll find it on December 16th, 22nd, and 24th. Check your local listings. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about descriptive narration, plus Stuart Nolman is along with another edition of Book Banter. We do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, all here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click the Google Play or iTunes button located at the website, thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Let's get back to the stuff. Okay, it happens all the time. A vehicle crashes into a building, causing damage and sometimes injury because brakes don't function or a driver steps on the wrong pedal. In the case of 28-year-old Keith Rio Cavalier, however, there was more to this story. Cavalier drove his 1997 Toyota Tacoma into a glass wall at the Harrison County Courthouse in Gulfport, Mississippi on November the 10th at around 6 a.m. The building was empty, so there were no injuries, and Cavalier can be clearly seen on surveillance video climbing out of the truck and leaving the scene. When police caught up to him, Cavalier told them he intentionally struck the building in order to report drug paraphernalia had been stolen from him. It will come as no surprise that Cavalier was found to have been driving under the influence, and he was arrested. He was held at the county jail on $25,000 bond. Now, even when hammered, people should know that if you are going to report an alleged crime to the police, that the cops don't have a drive-through service. Yeah. 26-year-old Catherine Lee Mehta of Arlington, Texas, accepted a gig to photograph a wedding at the Springs Event venue in Weatherford on November 24th. But she became the star of the show when wedding guests discovered her having sex with another guest in a room at the venue. A security guard summoned Parker County Sheriff's deputies, who found Mehta yelling by a fountain on the property. According to their report, she then walked to a tree and urinated. While she waited in the back of the patrol car, Mehta screamed, "Y'all families will be dead by Christmas! Y'all's daughters will be dead! My dad is going to find out about this, and y'all are dead! D-E-A-D!" Well, even in her condition, she can still spell. At the jail, officers found a bottle of anxiety pills, which they believe she mixed with alcohol, causing her erratic behavior. She faces charges of public intoxication and obstruction retaliation. So, I'm guessing the happy couple at the wedding won't be getting any pictures of their nuptials, eh? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Okay, here's a cautionary tale for people who work in government offices. It's important that you know your country's geography. A District of Columbia clerk and a supervisor refused to accept a New Mexico man's driver's license as he sought a marriage license because she and her supervisor believed New Mexico was a foreign country. Oh, let me repeat that. Two clerks in Washington, D.C. thought New Mexico was a foreign country. Wow. Gavin Clarkson said it happened November 20th at the District of Columbia Court's Marriage Bureau as he tried to apply for a marriage license. After approaching the clerk for a license and showing his New Mexico ID, Clarkson said the clerk told him he needed an international passport to get the marriage license. Clarkson said he protested to a supervisor who also told him that he needed a foreign passport. The clerk finally concluded New Mexico was a state after Clarkson objected three times. The clerk granted the license to Clarkson and his fiance. She thought New Mexico was a foreign country, Clarkson said of the clerk. All the couples behind us waiting in line were laughing. Clarkson, who was an enrolled member of the Choctaw Nation, said if he'd had his tribal identification card, he might have had an easier time than showing his New Mexico driver's license. In a statement, the D.C. court systems acknowledged the staff error. We understand that a clerk in our marriage bureau made a mistake regarding New Mexico's 106-year history as a state, Lee H. Gurowitz, spokeswoman for D.C. court, said in an email. We very much regret the error and the slight delay it caused a New Mexico resident in applying for a D.C. marriage license. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, New Mexico became a U.S. state in 1912. Wow. These are the same kind of people who wouldn't get the puzzle on Wheel of Fortune even if there was only one letter left to turn. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Descriptive narration is something that most people never come into contact with and don't even think about. But for those who are visually impaired, it means the world for being able to understand and enjoy film and television. Roy Samuelson is one of the top industry voices in descriptive narration. He joins us on the line from California to talk about this unique gig. Hi, Roy.
Hey, how's it going today?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us. You do something that, quite frankly, most of us never get a chance to experience. Tell us how different, because, I mean, a lot of us are in voice work, either commercials or narration or cartoons or film. How different is this from the other types of narration that you normally do? Because you do all other types of voice work as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities, and descriptive narration takes a lot of the essences of narration and promo work and some other aspects, and just kind of lumps it all together into one big fell swoop.
How big of an industry is this becoming? Because I would assume that at one point there wasn't a lot of descriptive narration for those who were blind or visually impaired. But now more and more work is being done in that regard.
Well, there's even as recently as a few months ago, Hulu has now agreed to give access to blind and low vision audience members to consume their content. So there are very important steps that are being made, I guess, but there's still a long way to go.
Describe for us what it's like to do what you do in this genre. What exactly are the blanks you're filling in for the visually impaired?
Oh, that's a great question. So just to kind of wrap your head around it, it's kind of like listening to a baseball game on the radio. What I do is I do read a script that's pre-written for me. At the same time, I'm looking at the actual live video and listening to the audio for whatever feature or TV show that I'm narrating. And The gist of it is that in between lines of dialogue, there's words that I say that kind of fill in the blanks of what's happening on screen.
Is it difficult sometimes when dialogue is rapid fire? Are there times when something needs to be described, but you don't have the space or time to do it?
Absolutely. There's, the old picture is worth 1,000 words. And if you figure there's 24 frames a second, there's a lot of stuff going on. So what the describers who write the script, not the narrators, but the people who actually are writing the script for descriptive narration do, is find the elements of the story that are most important to be told and make sure that those are put in.
How much of an opportunity do you have to experience what others experience from the work you do? In other words, do you get feedback to get an idea that the descriptive narration is actually a help as opposed to a hindrance, you know, akin to the guy who was sitting next to you in the theater who won't stop talking?
That's a really good example. Two different experiences. At the movie theaters, there are special wireless headsets as well as a special app on smartphones that feeds into the listener the content for descriptive narration, so it's not, blasting to everybody. Specifically for TV shows, there's a special audio program channel, a secondary audio program channel, that kind of lives on top of what most people who are watching the show experience. And that gets toggled on and off. If you've ever accidentally turned on dubbing for a foreign film, or you've accidentally turned on closed captioning, it can be a distraction. So if you don't want it on, it can definitely sound like a nuisance. But for people who do appreciate it, it's it gives that extra little element.
Have you had the opportunity to hear from people who require this service and how helpful it is to them? And does that in turn improve how descriptive narration works going forward? Because we're talking about something that is obviously designed and created by those who are not hearing impaired, so they might not know the nuances that are necessary to perfectly do the job for those who need the service.
Sure. The different companies that are accessibility focused, companies being the people that hire me, or even the networks and the studios, they are becoming more aware of inclusivity when it comes to this kind of stuff across the board. So for the visually impaired or low vision or blind people, they have been reaching out and commenting about things that they like. There's certain narrators that they prefer, and being exposed to that, I think is great to hear what works for the audience and what they want to hear. It's really exciting to see that is something that is important to them. It's not a necessity. It's definitely an enhancement. This is not a need. It's something it's definitely appreciated, and it's kind of neat to see how that's happening. The companies that do hire me are very receptive to the community, and they like to hear what the community is looking for and what works for them. So as it grows, it's been growing. I don't want to say that this is a new thing, but as it grows, I think there is a definite give and take and responsiveness.
I want to give the audience a little example of what we're talking about. I'm going to play a little clip from one of the jobs that you did, The Imitation Game, which is a movie starring Benedict Cumberbatch. We'll play that now and discuss it on the other side.
I need a new message. The latest intercept.
Peter brings over a piece of paper and gives it to Joan. Alan rearranges the machine's wires. John grabs a notebook and pencil.
Hello?
Ready?
Yes.
M.
M.
Y.
Y.
M.
M.
S.
S.
A.
A.
I.
I.
C.
C.
T.
T.
R.
R.
As Alan
I.
types on the keys,
S. S.
different letters
o.
above
o.
them light up.
A.
A. John writes them
y.
down.
Y.
R.
R.
I.
I.
John holds up the small notebook, and Hugh reads.
Okay, Miss Jaguar, its Alphapunkt is directed to 53 degrees 24 minutes north and Alphapunkt 1 degree west.
Hi, Hitler.
With a stunned look, Alan lifts his hands from the machine. Joan covers her mouth.
Turns out that's the only German you need to know to break Enigma.
He smiles tearfully. John gives a brief grin. Alan chuckles in relief, and Hugh swings the notebook.
Yes!
Joan hugs Alan, while Hugh hugs John. Peter grins as he holds his hands to his head. Joan smiles proudly at Alan, who beams at the Enigma machine. Peter throws his arms around Hugh, and John hugs Alan. As Joan embraces Hugh, he briefly lifts her off the ground. Hugh turns to Alan, and their smiles fade. He gives a solemn nod, and Alan grins faintly. Smiling, Alan sits back down at the machine as the others celebrate. Peter hugs him from behind. He steps away, and Alan stares at the machine with an emotional expression.
That was a clip from the movie The Imitation Game, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, featuring Roy's work doing descriptive narration. So, Roy, tell us about what we just heard.
So this is the final section of this sample demo of the descriptive narration. And it's one of the things that I love about this particular section is that it does show that I am playing a character. I'm the narrator. I'm not the guy that's talking. I'm actually a part of the story. So if a listener is listening to me and not paying attention to the story, I'm not doing my job right. I think that's one of the biggest things about descriptive narration is the spotlight stays on the story and not the narrator.
Now that you've been doing this for a while, have you reached a point where you actually get recognized by those who are visually impaired? Like if you go to a supermarket, somebody turns around and goes, I know that voice.
It's funny that that has happened a few times. And the more I'm interacting with audience members on social media, it's been fun to hear what their experience is like and what they appreciate about this this kind of work.
What are they saying to you about that?
One of the things that's really touched me the most is I show up, I'm given a script, 2 seconds later they start recording, and basically an hour later I'm done. I'm in a booth and there's a director and an engineer. So that's pretty much the team that I'm working with when I'm actually doing the work. So to find out that people are actually enjoying the descriptive narration, it's really touching.
I've always said that the definition of crazy is working as a voice specialist because you're basically sitting by yourself in a padded room.
Yeah.
Roy, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Voice actor Roy Samuelson, talking about the world of descriptive narration. You can find out more about Roy's work by going to his website at roysamuelson.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0485, and you'll find the link to his site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Listen to this list of products and see if you can guess what they all have in common. Indoor extension cords, gasoline, wood matches, and fishing lures. Tough one, right? The answer is that versions of all these products carry a very scary-sounding warning label. It goes, "This product contains a chemical known to the state of California to cause cancer." That warning has been required on all kinds of products in California for more than 25 years, so a researcher there decided to see if cancer rates in that state are any lower than in places without that warning. His conclusion, reported in the Wall Street Journal, is that there isn't a single empirical study demonstrating any public health benefits. Let's be fair, the law must help someone, right? Well, the label on the fishing lure does warn, harmful if swallowed, so maybe some fish have benefited. But seriously, the law has created a lawsuit industry that has cost consumers plenty, and that's the real problem. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And direct from the mean streets of Pittsburgh, and by that I mean Mean Joe Green, we have Stuart Nallman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Yeah, I thought you were going to mean the smokestacks of all those steel mills of Pittsburgh. That was once kind of mean also.
Yes.
Yeah, it was. But this edition of Book Banter, yes, we are going to Pittsburgh, but we're going to explore the world of Dr. Daniel Rinaldi. He's a psychologist who also serves as a consultant with the police department of his native Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in which he specifically deals with the victims of violent crimes and the trauma that they go through as a result. After a typical long day of dealing and working with such sensitive cases, Dr. Rinaldi likes to unwind by listening to jazz or CD, especially by Miles Davis, on his home stereo system. However, it is one of those nights, as Rinaldi was listening to a Miles Davis CD, that a bullet was fired right through his front window and embedded itself into a wall inside his home. Now, somehow he unwillingly ends up in the middle of a domestic dispute that he never wanted to get mixed up with, which involved his neighbor Joyce Stedman and her boyfriend, in which she told her jilted lover that she was currently dating Dr. Rinaldi, which, of course, was false. And this rather near-fatal misunderstanding evolved into one of Dr. Rinaldi's most bizarre, disturbing, and violent cases of his career, which is told in breathless detail in Dennis Palumbo's latest potboiler, Head Wounds.
And as many people on this show know, I am a big, big Dennis Palumbo fan and love the Daniel Rinaldi series, so I thought I'd get that out there right away.
Well, and why not? Hey, look, you know, express it, you know, you like him. Why not? There's nothing wrong with that. Now, Head Wounds, as you know, Peter, is the fifth novel featuring Dr. Daniel Rinaldi. And even if you haven't read the previous four Rinaldi mysteries, Head Wounds will automatically draw you into the story from the beginning and relentlessly won't let you go until its bizarre, fiery conclusion. And from that single gunshot in the nighttime, Rinaldi is thrust into a deadly cat-and-mouse game with Sebastian Maddox, a highly psychotic computer geek and murderer who is a cross between Hannibal Lecter and Scorpio, the much detested sniper killer from the first Dirty Harry movie. Through his mastery of computer technology, Maddox follows Rinaldi through his cell phones and laptop computers to bait him and cause him physical and psychological harm by killing people whom Rinaldi is familiar with, whether they be colleagues, patients, or close friends. Now, this book is clearly crafted and certainly delivers when it comes to the edge of your seat suspense. Just as you breathlessly follow Rinaldi in his pursuit to prevent another victim at the hands of Sebastian Maddox, Palumbo brings about another twist that is just as terrifying and just as chilling. And like Mike Hammer with New York and Sam Spade with San Francisco, Palumbo effectively uses Rinaldi's hometown of Pittsburgh as a canvas of what his world is all about, where he plies his trade from the suburbs like Oakland to PNC Park, which is the home of the Pittsburgh Pirates. So Head Wounds is an absorbing crime thriller that you will sharply broadside you every time you think that Dr. Daniel Rinaldi will come to the logical conclusion of a certain aspect of this very dark case.
Hmm. The book is as if I don't know, but I have to ask. The book is
yeah. Just for those who just tuned in right now, it's Head Wounds by Dennis Palumbo. It's published by Poison Pen Press, and it's $24.95.
And it's also fantastic. Now,
yes, I agree.
Usually I ask you a question at this moment, which is, what other books in this genre do you recommend? But I want to recommend something.
Okay.
And you're probably going to say, well, you've read the previous four books, so it only stands to fitting that I would recommend the previous four to this fifth book as what I recommend that everyone read. But I've said that time and time again. I'm a Dennis Palumbo evangelist, so people know I'm going to talk about the previous Rinaldi books. So I won't.
Oh, you won't.
But
so
what I recommend? What I will recommend is an anthology series written by, wait for it, Dennis Palumbo.
I knew he'd have to surface somehow.
This book is called From Crime to Crime, Mind-Boggling Tales of Mystery and Murder, and it involves short stories, mostly short stories, or I should rephrase that, several short stories by a group of friends who call themselves the Smart Guys Marching Society, a collection of amateur sleuths who resemble the author and his closest friends. I say most of these stories because there are several stories in the book, but the last three stories do not involve the Smart Guys Marching Society, mm-hmm. but they're great stories all in the book, including one of the ones that doesn't involve the Smart Guys Marching Society, which is a historical thriller, short story, that deals with a young Albert Einstein.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like so before Theory of Relativity, you mean.
So this book is a fantastic book. And as you know, you're the one who does a lot of recreational reading. That's who you are. I wasn't doing a lot of recreational reading for quite a few years. And to get back into it, to get back into reading big time, full time, this was a book I picked up because it was short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fantastic. I don't even know where my copy is because I have passed that along to several people in the family, and now I don't even think it's in the province anymore. I think it's somewhere out west. Somebody else is loving it. I wish I had my copy back.
Well, you know, you could maybe speak to Dennis in the future and say, hey, look, I like this anthology. I just got it. It crossed me borders. Disappeared, no. Missing in action. Please send me another copy.
No, I will buy it. It deserves to be purchased. It's a great book. But anyway, that's the one I recommend for anybody else who's trying to think about something along the genre of what Dennis already writes with the Danny Rinaldi stories. Now, again, I didn't take yours. What do you have?
Well, I mean, speaking of mysteries, I do recommend the book that I read. I did leisure reading in the summer, Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None.
Ah, excellent.
Which is, they say, is the best-selling mystery of all time. And also, speaking of race against time, against psychotic killers, I recommend Thomas Harris's Red Dragon. That's sort of like the prequel to Silence of the Lambs,
mm-hmm.
in which a detective enlists the help of Hannibal Lecter to track a psychotic serial killer whose inspiration is a lithograph by Edmund Blake called The Red Dragon. And it's pretty chilling, and it's almost resembles that race against time against a psychotic killer before he kills again resembles that premise in Head Wounds.
Wow. Okay. So again, this week's book is?
It's called Head Wounds by your favorite writer, one of your favorite writers, Peter Dennis Palumbo. And it's published by Poison Pen Press. I love the name of that. I love the alliteration. And it's $24.95.
And since you mentioned it, Poison Pen Press also has an anthology book out that highlights a lot of their other authors with short stories. You can check that one out, too. That's another one to toss into the hopper there. How can people find you, sir?
Well, it's not in the streets of Pittsburgh. It's in the pages of the Montreal Times every week. Or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter. And now, go Pirates, go!
Stuart Nelman. Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and a few more Stuff File news stories. But since we were just talking about books and we're also in the holiday season, allow me to be a little self-serving. It's about my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader, for you Kindle folks like me out there, on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at thestufffile.com. So, buy the book and enjoy it over the holidays. Thank you very much. Anyway, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Okay, this is the kind of story I love where the crooks are outsmarted by the staff. Two robbery suspects were arrested after their victims' quick thinking led police straight to them. Stephen Bivens and Sherrod Brown of Texas were arrested and charged with robbery by force or fear, assault while masked, and planning to perform an act of violence. It happened at about 7:30 p.m. at the T-Mobile store. The entire thing was caught on the store's surveillance video. Police said two masked men walked into the store and started demanding items. They brandished a small baseball bat and began threatening the employees at the store. Brown and Bivens allegedly rounded up the young employees, two young employees, forced them into a back room in the store and ordered them to fill a garbage bag with the store's priciest merchandise. They placed approximately 30 Apple and Samsung cell phones into a trash bag, altogether worth nearly $30,000. Before the two left, they also allegedly took one of the employees' ID badges, threatening to, quote, come back and get him if he reported the incident to the police. A terrifying order the young employees didn't take to heart. They immediately called 911, gave police a description of the two, as well as the key to finding them quickly. The thing that the suspects did not know is that the employees put in one cell phone that had a GPS tracker on it. Officers used the GPS tracker to lead them straight to Brown and Bivens, who allegedly still had the phones and the bat in their car. T-Mobile employees said even if the two had gotten away with the phones, they would have been reported stolen and rendered useless to anyone who had them. God, I love that story. I'm sure that robber will carry through with his threat and come back after the employee years from now, when he gets out of prison. A man contacted the Spartanburg County, South Carolina Sheriff's Office to report that he had been the victim of a fraud. The unidentified man, in his 60s, told deputies he was given false information about an organization in which he thought about joining, but instead, they stole his money. He had been approached by people letting him know he could join the organization by sending a $250 down payment. He sent the $250, followed by another $2,000. Then he realized he might have been the victim of fraud and contacted the sheriff's office. The organization he wanted to join? The Illuminati. Yeah. I'm curious. When you send money to the Illuminati, do you have to use a secret account? A Florida woman faces an aggravated assault charge after authorities say she passed gas in line at a dollar store and pulled a knife on a man who complained about it. 37-year-old Shanita Yvette Wilson passed gas while waiting in line at a Dollar General store on Sunday night and upset a nearby customer. The report says the offended customer and Wilson then got into an argument. It says Wilson then pulled a small folding knife out of her purse and told the victim she was going to, quote, gut him while moving as if to attack him. Wilson was arrested and charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon without intent to kill. Well, perhaps in prison they can correct her diet. And you know how we often mention on this show that everything happens at Walmart? Well, it actually does. A man accidentally shot himself in the groin area while inside a Buckeye, Arizona Walmart. The man was in the Walmart store at around 6:30 p.m. when the semi-automatic handgun began to slip as he carried it unholstered in the waistband of his sweatpants. Wow. Obviously, he doesn't know anything about gravity and sweatpants. The man told police that when he tried to reposition his loaded gun and keep it from falling, he shot himself in the groin. Officers arrived and found the man in the meat department with a gunshot wound. Oh, that's irony for you. He was taken to hospital with survivable injuries. No one else was hurt during the incident. Police said all indications are the shooting was accidental, but police did file a report for unlawful discharge of a firearm. I was seriously considering making him the idiot of the day, but I won't. You know, we haven't had further reports to find out how Jim and the twins are doing. Again, I don't understand why you need to be walking around Walmart with a gun in your sweatpants, but to each his own, I guess. I did mention the idiot of the day just a moment ago. And now, boys and girls, it is the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
46-year-old Richard Robert Langley of Kansas City, Missouri, was working part-time for the Platte Woods Police Department in October when he decided to take part in the department's drug take-back program. Except, according to court documents, Langley wasn't disposing of drugs. He had been helping himself to pills that had been collected in Lake Wacomas. And to make matters worse, his own body camera captured evidence enabling prosecutors to charge him with felony theft of a controlled substance. Langley is scheduled to appear in court on December the 10th. Now, why, oh why, would you, as a part-time police officer, attempt to steal drugs from the very station you work at while wearing a body cam? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0485. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0485. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.